this president's agenda for the Arctic is let's take a look at what is up there and let's see what it is that we can develop.
Interior Secretary Salazar outlines plans for development in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 8th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a new wave of gold fever hits Alaska.
There's lots of people that are weekend warrior suction dredgers that go out and just wash the rocks and keep the pretty ones.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Business leaders in Alaska got a chance to meet with Interior Secretary Ken Salazar this morning. He is in the state for a third time in as many years to discuss development issues. At this morning's roundtable, representatives from Native corporations, oil companies, and other industries pressed the need for a more streamlined permitting process for development. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Regulatory morass is how CIRI President Margie Brown describes the permitting process for developing natural resources. CIRI hosted the roundtable discussion with Secretary Salazar, Senator Mark Begich, and more than a dozen business leaders from around the state. Brown urged Salazar to make it easier for Alaska to be able to contribute its resources to the nation.
And we believe that we, of course, need permits. Nobody wants to mess up Alaska. We are Alaskans. We love this state. But there must be balance, and we must figure out a way to achieve that balance once again.
The Interior Department is already moving to make the permitting process in the state more straightforward. President Obama signed an executive order this July creating an interagency working group to coordinate development in Alaska. Salazar says it should give industry more certainty on what the federal government will allow and what it won't.
It's very reflective of the initiative which Senator Begich has been working on for the last couple of years in the Senate, wanting us to make sure that we're not tripping over each other and essentially creating dysfunction in government because you have one agency doing one thing and then being tripped up by another agency.
One of the big development issues Salazar is weighing in Alaska is offshore oil and gas development in the Arctic Ocean. Last week, his agency gave Shell conditional approval to drill up to 4 exploratory wells in the Beaufort Sea next summer. Salazar describes the administration's strategy in the area.
This president's agenda for the Arctic is to go ahead, let's take a look at what is up there, and let's see what it is that we can develop.
If Shell's plan goes through, it will be the first offshore drilling in the Arctic since the Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. Environmental groups say a similar tragedy in the Arctic would be devastating, and they say the government isn't ready to respond. Salazar himself pointed out that the nearest Coast Guard base to the Arctic is hundreds of miles away in Kodiak.
The facts of the Arctic are that you don't have that huge amount of infrastructure that we had in the Gulf of Mexico that was able to respond. And so I do get worried when I think about the fact that we don't have a lot of those kinds of resource responses up in the northern part of Alaska.
But Salazar says dozens of exploratory wells have been safely drilled in the Beaufort Sea before. And he says with the right precautions, more exploratory drilling is a step in the right direction. Almost all of the roundtable participants represented traditional resource extraction industries. But Chris Rose with Renewable Energy Alaska Project, or REAP, was sitting at the table too. He told Salazar Alaska could be a world leader in renewable energy development.
And there's 1.6 billion people on the planet that have no electricity. We could be optimizing systems for the villages here and exporting that technology.
Salazar says the president's view is that the country needs a longer-term approach to renewable energy.
I think one of the things that we have done with renewable energy that has not been helpful to our country is that we've had a start-and-stop approach to renewable energy, and whether it's the investment tax credits, the production tax credits, the recovery grants, the DOE guarantee loans, and all the rest of the incentives, it's come and it's gone.
Salazar says dozens of geothermal and wind projects are currently moving forward on public lands, but he says more work needs to be done. He says Alaska is so unique it may require its own renewable energy action plan. He plans to visit Denali National Park, Barrow, the North Slope, and the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The Obama administration announced today that it plans to start giving states waivers from the No Child Left Behind education reform bill. Congress is stalled on reauthorizing the federal education law, and many states are having trouble meeting the law's standards for adequate yearly progress. The original goal of No Child Left Behind was for all students to be proficient in basic reading and math by 2014. With that deadline approaching, states are finding that more difficult than anticipated, particularly for special needs students. Melody Barnes, the chairwoman of the White House Domestic Policy Council, said the administration can't afford to wait any longer for Congress to act to reform No Child Left Behind.
I am pleased to announce today that President Obama has directed Secretary Duncan to move forward with plans to provide flexibility from No Child Left Behind to states that are willing to embrace reform.
The announcement today contained no specifics about what the terms will be, but in general, Education Secretary Arne Duncan said they will begin giving waivers to states that propose their own ways of meeting standards. They will announce more details next month. Alaska Education Department spokesman Eric Fry said the state will certainly be interested, but he couldn't comment further without knowing more details. The terms of No Child Left Behind require the adequate yearly progress measurement to escalate each year, and that's increasing the number of failing schools. Alaska and a number of other states have said they can show progress but want to use different standards known as growth or trend models. Secretary Duncan said he would be open to that.
And so where we're seeing progress, we want to reward that. Where you have, you know, schools or districts where things are getting worse, well, we'll be very tough-minded there. And so the basic concept of AYP is going to be fundamentally different. This is not a tweak. This is a basic change.
Duncan said he hopes this can be a transition or bridge to a new education law, but reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act is already 4 years overdue. The price of gold has hit a new high of over $1,700 an ounce. It's the latest surge in precious metal prices in recent years, and it's driving a lot of interest in gold in Alaska. Bobby Curry, the general manager of Oxford Assaying and Refining in Fairbanks, says business is good.
We've got people who bought gold back when it was $300 that are bringing it in and selling it now at, you know, $1,600 plus. And you have people that are going, not necessarily the doomsdayers, but they're going, wow, with the world economy the way it's going, we need to invest in something that's a solid, so when paper falls or deteriorates, we have something that's worth more.
Curry says the company deals in gold nuggets, coins, and bullion. He says they also handle a lot of raw gold due to a small-scale mining boom.
We're on a record pace this year. We've already set a whole new record for our company in 31 years of refining here in Alaska. And our daily volume is just unbelievable right now with the miners. Because at $1,600 gold, there's way more people mining. There are tons of mom-and-pop operations. And there's lots of people that are weekend warrior suction dredgers that go out and just wash the rocks and keep the pretty ones.
The state has four public mining areas, one each near Eureka and Talkeetna, and two in Nome. State Department of Natural Resources mining geologist Bill Cole says Nome's West Beach area opened this year in response to public demand.
We've seen a steady increase in interest in dredging offshore in Nome generally, and particularly in the public mining areas.
Cole says most of the small-scale operations in Alaska are on existing claims, but that new claims are also being staked. A record number of mining permit applications are being processed for work on state and federal lands. Steve Lundeen, the statewide mine inspection coordinator with the Bureau of Land Management in Fairbanks, says activity has risen dramatically.
Between 2005 and this summer, we have gone from having half of our 120 operations inactive to right now, virtually they all have some level of activity on them, either exploratory or actually mining.
Lundeen says there's also new claim staking happening on federal land, despite a fairly limited amount of BLM property that's open. He says the agency is looking at opening new areas. He says Alaska saw a similar mining boom when the price of gold spiked in the 1980s. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly.
One, two, three.
A healthcare window opens for Mexicans in Alaska. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth. As a result, organizations often become stronger. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
The case challenging the Alaska Redistricting Board remap of legislative districts is slowly proceeding. A status hearing was held Friday on three consolidated suits filed by the Fairbanks North Star Borough, two local residents, and the city of Petersburg. The revision of Fairbanks districts would pit incumbent Democratic State Senators Joe Thomas and Joe Pascvan against one another. Fairbanks Borough Attorney Jill Dolan says plaintiffs are waiting on some key information to move forward.
Well, there's been three complaints filed so far, and the redistricting board has not filed its answer to that complaint. It certainly will make it easier for the parties to proceed if we know what the redistricting board's position is on our complaints.
The defense referenced a federal voting rights official's deployment to Africa for delaying the redistricting board's response to the complaints. The case is being watched around the state. During Friday's hearing, attorneys indicated the city of Ketchikan intends to intervene on the defense side. There's an expedited timeline for the case. A trial has been set for January, and the redistricting decision has to be rendered before a candidate filing deadline next summer. Three people have died in two fatal accidents that occurred in Nome and Elam in the early morning hours Sunday. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin reports.
Troopers in Nome received a call just after 4 in the morning Sunday that there was a vehicle collision 3 miles north of Nome. William Booth, also known as Chase, was riding a dirt bike on the Glacier Creek Road when he collided with a Chevrolet pickup driven by 22-year-old Bryce Warnicky Green. Trooper spokesperson Beth Ipson says the dirt bike Booth was driving did not have a headlight, and he was reportedly riding it on the wrong side of the road.
So when Bryce kind of came around a corner, and it was too late to see, Chase was actually in his lane, and they collided head-on.
Booth was wearing a helmet. Alcohol and marijuana involvement are suspected, and the crash is under investigation. Chase Booth was 19 years old and the son of two-time Iron Dog champion Evan Booth. And roughly 4 hours later, troopers in Nome were notified of a vehicle rollover on Moses Point Road, 2 miles north of Elam, a community of about 300 located on the southern Seward Peninsula. Trooper spokesperson Ipson says Heather Secuse was driving a Ford Ranger with five passengers when she lost control of the truck and it rolled about four times.
Heather was actually driving her cousin Arnold's vehicle, and she wasn't really familiar with it. In fact, not very much experience driving a stick shift. And she was actually driving pretty fast. We estimate probably somewhere between 60 and 7 miles an hour on the dirt and gravel road when it went out of control and flipped.
All but one passenger was ejected. Heather Secuse and Oscar Tuckuck, both 19 years old, were declared dead on the scene. Two passengers were flown to Anchorage for treatment of serious but non-life-threatening injuries. Two passengers were treated at the Elam Clinic for minor injuries. All occupants were from Elam, and alcohol and speed are factors in the crash. No one in the vehicle was wearing a seatbelt, and that crash is also under investigation. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kinnean.
Ventana means window in the Spanish language, and today a window opened up in Alaska for Mexicans in our state to receive improved health care through a Mexican government program called Ventanilla de Salud. The program aims to facilitate Mexican-American access to health care in the United States through advice, referrals, and free or low-cost preventative care.
One, two, three.
Anchorage-based Mexican consul Senor Javier Abud joined with city officials and Mexico's Secretary of Health, Dr. Jose Angel Cordoba, in cutting the ribbon to mark the opening of the health window during a brief ceremony this morning. Dr. Cordoba says the most recent program, one of 47 in the United States, is paid for by the Mexican government. The focus is on preventative health care.
Those programs are prepared in Mexico and are sent to the United States in every place where the migrants can come to the consulate to prevent diseases like secondaries of smoking, for example, or diseases secondary to obesity or overweight, or to detect diseases like cancer, diabetes, hypertension, heart disease.
The Ventanilla de Salud program works both ways, Dr. Cordoba says, providing health services for Mexican migrants and for their families that remain back in Mexico. After a pilot study over the past year, he says, the service is ready to formally begin in Alaska.
And we are working with the University of Alaska, and that the survey will be very important, because now that we are going to get the 50 Ventanillas de Salud at the 50 consulates, we need to homologate all the services that we are doing there. And for that, we are being supported by the different universities in each state.
The University of Alaska is working on a needs assessment study. Francisco Javier Diaz de Leon is the executive director of the Institute of Mexicans Abroad, an arm of the Mexican Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which works to establish a connection with Mexicans living outside their native country. He says 98% of all Mexican migrants live in the United States, and many of them do not understand that the U.S. does not have socialized health care, as does Mexico.
Most Mexicans, when they go outside the country, they assume that the way the medical system works in Mexico, that will happen outside the country too. And that's not the case in the United States, because the system is different. There's no obligation from the government to provide insurance to everybody.
The Institute works with agencies within the Mexican government to develop policies to help Mexicans outside Mexico. Diane Engel, director of Anchorage's Health and Human Services Department, says the Ventanilla de Salud provides the city with a microcosm to test out how to better help underserved populations within the city. The Consulate of Mexico is providing the municipality with $25,000 to pay for both outreach events and for a part-time employee who will work with the program in the consulate.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Federal scientists say they have tentatively identified the mysterious orange goo that showed up recently in a lagoon near Kivalina. It appears to be a concentration of microscopic eggs. Jeep Rice, research biologist at the Ted Stevens Marine Institute in Auk Bay, says their lab staff first tried to figure if it was plant, animal, or mineral. Several chemists were brought in because of concerns that it may be some kind of chemical pollution. But Rice says the chemists weren't needed once they spotted the basic egg structure under a high-powered microscope.
They're down in the micron range, which is, well, a herring egg would be about 1,000 microns, so they're down in the 1 to 10 or maybe even larger, a little bit larger than that, 10 microns. They're not very big at all. They're very, very small.
Since the eggs are so small and their internal features are very hard to distinguish, it's unclear what laid the eggs. Rice suspects some sort of invertebrate, perhaps a crustacean.
There it starts to get to be a mystery. They look like copepod eggs, but they're pretty small, so I don't know if it's a different species. These are samples from pretty remote areas, but often it's very hard to distinguish the eggs of different species. You have to kind of let them hatch and develop before you can really tell what they are. Sometimes with our commercial species like king crab and that sort of thing, we've got really good description of the eggs and the embryos and that sort of thing, so you can identify them. But for many, many species, we do not have those clear of descriptions, so to speak, or pictures of a lot of them.
The orange color of the goo seems to come from a lipid oil droplet in the center of each egg. The eggs that were collected for sampling either dried up or died despite being refrigerated for transport. Kivalina area residents were concerned earlier this month when the never-before-seen substance showed up. Rice says it's possible the eggs just happened to concentrate in that lagoon because of wind or tidal action. The company that wants to produce genetically modified salmon is pushing back against its critics, and it's gathering support from trade groups that claim politics are getting in the way of science. But opponents in Alaska say the arguments won't change their minds. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Alaska's fishing industry opposes commercial development of genetically modified salmon. That's led to congressional action to stop regulatory review, which could block production and sales. Now, the developer is fighting back. After turning down numerous interview requests, Aqua Bounty Technologies, which wants to market the fish, is speaking up. It's increased its conversations with the news media, and it's being joined by the Biotechnology Industry Organization and the Animal Agriculture Coalition, which includes fish, cattle, and poultry producers. Ronald Stottish is president of Massachusetts-based Aqua Bounty.
We understand the sensitivity of the fishermen and the fisheries industry in Alaska. However, our product, we believe, does not represent a threat to them, as it will simply displace an imported product that's coming in from offshore at the present time.
His company's fish are Atlantic salmon with an added Chinook gene that doubles growth speed. Opponents call them Frankenfish and wonder what other changes might be in store. Here's how Alaska Congressman Don Young put it when he pushed through an amendment that would keep the FDA from spending money on approving the product.
No one's had a chance to study the effect upon the wild salmon, or can they, in fact, pollute the wild salmon in kind. So I argue until that's done, there should be no making it legal.
His measure passed, and a similar one is pending in the Senate. Aqua Bounty Stottish says the modified salmon have been studied and shown to be safe.
It's been portrayed in the media as a bizarre concoction that's somehow natural. But the fact of the matter is that this is a change of less than 1/10,000th of 1% of the entire genetic material of the fish. That's less change than one normally sees, for instance, in normal sexual mating.
Critics worry that the fast-growing fish could escape and compete with Pacific species. British Columbia marine biologist Alexandra Morton says they could also affect parasites or diseases that prey on wild salmon.
We also don't know with the genetically modified fish how the different pathogens are going to respond to these fish and whether it's going to invite mutations or some other change in the pathogen situation.
A recent laboratory study showed genetically modified male salmon could spawn with wild female Atlantics. That led to concerns that escapees could establish their own populations or crossbreed with wild species. But Stottish says the salmon his company wants to market cannot escape or mate at all.
What the application is for land-based contained cultivation of all female, sterile as in unable to reproduce, populations that will be reared only in FDA-inspected facilities.
Other concerns include impacts on the market. Critics say retail customers' fears of genetically modified food could alienate them from all salmon, and they worry a faster-growing fish will take market share away from wild-caught Alaskan fish. Stottish says his product will compete against farmed Atlantics from Norway, Chile, and British Columbia, and that won't hurt the Alaska market.
A significant portion of the salmon consumed in the United States is the Atlantic salmon, which is a different species, and is marketed very differently and separately, and is, in fact, a source of significant trade deficit. And imported fish is basically being brought into the United States from great distances.
If approved by the FDA, he says his company will try raising the salmon in Panama. He also says he's found interest from fish farmers in the United States and Canada, though Canada's aquaculture trade group opposes genetic modifications. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
The Kuskokwim River had a massive chum salmon run this season. The fish may be called dog salmon, but it's gaining in popularity in international markets, and that's a good thing for small-time commercial fishermen on the river. KYUK's Shane Iverson reports.
5 cents a pound. That's what many Kuskokwim commercial fishermen were accustomed to receiving when they would sell their chum catch to the local fish buyer. But recently that's changing. This year, Coastal Villages Seafoods has been paying 85 cents a pound. A better indicator of the actual market value of the fish comes from Kuskokwim Seafoods, who, as a much smaller business, cannot subsidize their prices with pollock sales. Kuskokwim Seafoods is buying it for 25 cents a pound this year, still a 400% increase over the recent average. The reason, says Kuskokwim Seafoods manager Stuart Curry, is more interest in wild Alaska salmon, and not just kings or reds.
You know, most people are calling a chum a chum.
Curry says chums don't need any special marketing or rebranding for retailers to sell the fish meat. In fact, he says retailers have found that consistency is the key.
You don't want to call it wild Alaska salmon and, you know, sell them a chum one time and then try to sell them a pink the next time. They're not going to come back for that chum.
Of all the commercial species on the Kuskokwim, chum is still the least profitable, but Curry has reason to believe that the market has room to grow, especially for the Kuskokwim chum.
We're fortunate to have some of the best meat-colored chums that come into the river. So we're on par or better than any other chums produced in the state.
The Kuskokwim fishermen themselves are a unique breed in the industry. Curry says Kuskokwim Seafoods' largest buyer is a chain called Whole Foods Market. He's been to their stores, and he jokes that their customers call the chain Whole Paycheck.
They're willing to pay a premium.
The chain calls itself the largest supplier of whole and organic foods in the world. Through their distribution, Kuskokwim chums and other species are appearing in supermarkets and making their way to dinner tables across the United States and the United Kingdom.
They really have buyers that care about quality, their customers, that also care about sustainability, and who like the fact that they're buying from, you know, buying fish that was bought from fishermen who are smaller operators who really respect their fish and take care of their fish.
For Curry, the challenge will be cashing in on that market desire. Wild Alaska salmon is already emerging as a brand. Curry wants to see if there's room for a Kuskokwim brand too. Last year, the company shipped fish to their buyers in generic boxes. This year, they're using boxes that say Kuskokwim Seafoods.
So when they get a box of our product, they know that it came from the Kuskokwim.
For KYUK, I'm Shane Iverson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org or follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lorelei Kanin in Nome, Matt Miller and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Shane Iverson in Bethel. APRN Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Check the status of your application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for placing half in a college savings account and to add or change charitable donations. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. We all need energy to power our homes and businesses. Tapping renewable energy sources like wind, geothermal, and hydro helps keep our economy local, creating jobs, revenue, and power for the state. Learn more at realaska.org. This message sponsored by Renewable Energy Alaska Project, committed to creating a sustainable economic future for Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.